studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Tom DeHaven returns this week. We last talked with him after the publication of his great novel, It's Superman, a fine retelling of the Superman legend as if Superman were in the real world that we live in. During our last conversation, Tom DeHaven told us that he was working on a nonfiction book examining the history and character of the Man of Steel. Now that book, our hero, Superman on Earth, has been published, and true to his word, Tom DeHaven returns to discuss it with us. Tom DeHaven, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So before we talk about your new book, I want to ask you, you wrote this book, It's Superman, and I know you've written like a dozen novels, but mm-hmm. I think that you're going to be most remembered, I guess, you're most well known, I think, for It's Superman, that has its own Wikipedia page and and lots of fans and critics. But as I was reading your new book, I was thinking, you're part of the history of Superman now. What do you think about that?
Well, it's pretty strange to me. I mean, I had no intention of spending what turned out to be 8 years of my life involved with Superman. It just worked out that way. But you're absolutely right about the novel having this life, and I'm really delighted about it. It's coming out in a new mass market edition in March, I've been told. So it is part of the Superman story.
It's kind of incredible that you got the opportunity to do that, because you would think that they wouldn't want anybody monkeying around with Superman.
Well, they don't, actually, in many ways. It's funny, the people I've worked with at DC on the Superman project, the special projects editor, was a delightful guy, and I never had any problems with the editorial side of DC, but about 2 months before the novel came out, I got a call from the lawyers there, and they ran through the riot act with me about if I talk about Superman, I have to say that I didn't create Superman and all this kinds of stuff. So they're you know, in some ways, they're a schizophrenic company. And when I was finishing up Our Hero, I was contractually obligated to provide Yale with 15 images. And so I went back to D.C., a company I've worked for off and on for years. I mean, I'd done a graphic novel script for them in the 90s. And I said, could I have use of some Wayne Boring pictures and this cover and that cover? And they turned me down flat, absolutely flat. And not only did they turn me down flat, but they wrote one of those chilling letters that authors do not want to get.
A cease and desist kind of thing?
Yeah, saying, if you use any of these things, you'll be open to lawsuits. And so if you look, you see in the book, I mean, the only Superman comic image is Action Comics number one, and all the images had to come from films and cartoons and TV shows and things like that, which worked out fine. But when I was, there's sections of the book where, for instance, I describe one cartoonist and how he does Superman, and it would have been really nice to have an illustration
there, yeah.
So they're a funny company, they protect their properties as diligently as I've heard Disney does.
Well, now, and let's talk a little bit about this book. It's called Superman, Our Hero. Our Hero, Superman on Earth.
Right.
And it's in a series called American Icons. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. That has in it, a book on Scarlett O'Hara and the hamburger. I think there was one that was supposed to be on the electric chair and the Little Red Schoolhouse. Just these kind of iconic images. From American history, and trying to, in 50,000 words or so, trying to sum up the essence of a particular image or a character. And it was a great opportunity for me. I'd always wanted to do a nonfiction book, see if I could I could do one of those things. I'd done a lot of essays and reviews and things in my career, but I had never done a full-length book, so this was a great opportunity.
Well, yeah, when we talked a couple of years ago, I got the feeling that it was going to be a little tiny book. But it's a substantial book that required quite a bit of research.
Oh, yeah. I've said this often, that had I known what was involved in this, I probably would have said no, because what I thought was going to be, at most a year's work ended up being 3 years' work, two years almost entirely spent with trying to get all this stuff together. When you realize how much Superman material there has been since 1938 in all fields, and it was overwhelming, and then to try and find a through line to make this all hang together as a narrative. This was written not for comics fans so much as a general reader, so I had to not assume a whole lot of knowledge on the basis of someone who was reading the book. So yeah, partway through the project, I said, boy, I'd rather be writing fiction. Fiction is way easier than this stuff.
There's no fact-checking in your fiction.
Yeah, no. Well, I do fact-check stuff, but if I get it wrong, it's not going to be the end of the world.
Yeah. There is much to delight comic book fans also. I mean, yes, I can see that it's interesting for the general reader, but if you're a Superman fan, it's fantastic. Do you think, thinking about... how many, and I can't remember the numbers that you came up with in your book, but I mean thousands and thousands of Superman stories that have been told in one form or another, radio, newspaper strips, television, movies, and of course comics. Do you think there's any fictional character that has, I mean, Sherlock Holmes, Tarzan can't compare, I don't think, to Superman?
No, it really can't. I mean, Sherlock Holmes continues to be pastiched, in novels every year or so. There's, Dracula meets Sherlock Holmes. But really, there aren't any. Mickey Mouse for a while was ubiquitous and hasn't been since, the late 40s. And Superman continues to chug along in different incarnations. I mean, when I was doing the research for... our hero. Smallville had just come on, or it was like maybe the second season or something, because in fact DC Comics sent me a DVD of several episodes from the first season. And
now
it's like the 10th season. So, yeah, these things have incredible malleability. I even heard that they were thinking of doing a movie version of Smallville, calling it Metropolis. So, yeah, these things keep on morphing into...
But no movie version of It's Superman by Tom DeHaven, no?
No, no. Of course, that's a dream, and on the Internet that's been talked about a lot, which is very nice to hear. But no. In fact, not to badmouth DC, but when It's Superman came out, or was coming out, the Superman Returns was coming out about 6 or 7 months later, and I got a call. Superman had come out in the winter, and I got a call in the spring again from lawyers from somewhere, they're from Warner's or from DC Comics, telling me that I could no longer do any interviews about Superman for 3 months before the release of Superman Returns or 3 months after, because they were afraid I would confuse the public that thinking that this movie was based on something of mine. So there, I didn't listen to them really.
No, you went ahead and did interviews anyway.
Yeah,
what are they going
to
do?
Someone wanted to interview me. What are they going to do? But, but no, they're still. Actually, there's been talk about another Superman film, supposedly masterminded, if not directed by. The guy who's been doing the Batman movies. I forget his name.
Nolan.
Right, Christopher Nolan. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you did say in your book that you never turned down an interview, which diminished somewhat my...
I don't get that many of them, believe me.
my pride in landing an interview with Tom DeHaven. But the story that you tell of the origin of Superman... the two boys who concocted the thing, and what happened to them, it's kind of a sad story. I mean, it's a very sad story, and it gets sadder and sadder as the years go by. So I could see how maybe a DC or National Periodical Publications, as they were once known, might not want to tell that, have you tell that story again. But of course, I want you to tell it again right now. So these two guys, Siegel and Shuster, how old were they when they came up with Superman?
Well, the story flip-flops around, but it's generally they were in high school. I guess maybe juniors or seniors in high school, and they had been doing comics together, and Jerry had been writing science fiction stories on the, you know, and running it off on a mimeo machine, and Joe Shuster had been drawing pictures, and they had even done a novella that they had published this way called The Reign of the Superman, and this was back in 33 or 34, something like that, and the Superman in there was a villain, and the story that Jerry told with some changes. Interesting, Joe Shuster always was in the background. he really didn't ever get to tell his version very often, but Jerry, who was the writer, says it was in the summer of 1934 when he got the idea one summer night lying in bed, and you know, kept on jumping up and writing down you know, little ideas, you know, exploding planet and all that kind of stuff. And in the morning, ran it over to Joe's house, and they spent the day working up the character and the character's design. And the comic book itself, Action Comics number one, did not get published until May or June of 1938. So the story goes that they had this character for 4 years and could not sell it. They originally wanted to sell it, as did anybody in those days who was in the comics field, as a syndicated comic strip for the newspapers, but they couldn't. And then comic books, original material comic books, kind of started coming along around 35, 36, and they began to sell other features while holding Superman back, because they still believed this was a thing that could be a newspaper strip. And then finally, when the people at what is now DC Comics got hold of the strip and said they wanted to publish it, they basically said, okay, let's do it. This may never get done otherwise.
So Action Comics number one was not the very first comic book with original material then?
No, it was not. Malcolm Willen Nicholson, who was the owner of National Comics, was the first publisher who put out original material comic books. And he's the guy who, you know, a couple months before Action Comics was launched, was pushed out of his own company and thus avoided becoming a millionaire. But so it was his company that started doing original material comics. Up until then, the first comic books reprinted newspaper strips.
So ruthless business, this comic book business. You know, you don't think about it when you're a kid reading it. You don't, especially if you grew up when I did, reading Marvel comics and thinking, oh, they're having a blast there in the bullpen.
Jack Kirby, who was Mr. Bullpen in Marvel Comics, has this great quote, which everybody in the comics field knows, and knows the truth of it. He said, comics will break your heart. It's a tough business, and has been a tough business from the beginning, still is now. I just saw on one of the comic blogs this morning, the comics reporter, that DC announced yesterday they're cutting 20% of their staff.
Wow. So, Dick Ayers, who illustrated thousands of comic books in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, once told me that the entire time he was an illustrator, he had to also work as a night watchman in a garage.
Yeah, I was at a comics convention in Bethesda last week, SPX, which is the Alternative Comics Convention, and I was talking to a bunch of people there, and I was talking to a guy named Dan Nadell, who is a designer and anthologist and publisher, and we were just talking about how many of these guys, you know, has never been written about, but their stories are fascinating. But the thing that kind of the glue among all of them is that they were all shafted to one degree or another by this business that they love to be in.
We're talking with Tom DeHaven, and his new book is called our hero, Superman on Earth, and it's a history of Superman. So to get back to Siegel and Shuster for a minute, so they sold their rights to Superman for $135.
Yeah, $130.
Oh, I gave him $5.
Yeah, he gave him $5. You know they were told that this was the business-like way of doing things. That they sold, you know, they passed all their rights, and they were still kids. I mean, they were, I guess, around 20 years old by the time they sold it, something like that. But they were still kids, very unworldly. They did it, and lived to regret it for the rest of their lives. Well, not for the rest of their lives, basically after World War II. For the first few years, when they were really in charge of all this stuff, they were making pretty good money. But they were killing themselves because they had to produce an enormous amount of work. Once Action Comics was a success, then Superman Comics started, and so they had two monthly comic books to fill, and then they had to do the newspaper strip. So they were making fairly good money, I mean, about $35 a page, which wasn't bad in the Depression. But then they couldn't keep up with all the work, and Jerry went off to the war, and so his income dropped. He made money only if he produced. And when he came back, things had changed, and other people were doing the strip, and he couldn't really get back and make the kind of money that he'd made before, and regretted that decision to turn over all the rights to the company. And his big mistake in terms of his, not a mistake, but his big disaster was suing. He sued them. He had a 10-year contract with DC. And then in 1948, he convinced Joe Shuster to sue. And
they didn't take kindly to this.
No, they didn't. No. And the court, you know, threw it out because there it was. You know, they had signed over their rights, and it was right there in black and white, according to the courts of the time. And then DC Comics was infuriated by the bad publicity and also by the outrageous behavior of these two kids, as the publisher would always refer to them, you know, no matter how old they got, they were just blacklisted.
Well, it's really a horrible story, but there's so many little wonderful people that you talk about in your book who were in command of the Superman mythos for so many years, or rather, and during kind of my years of reading. In fact, I started reading, my first comic that I ever read was Superboy, number 123. And it had something to do with the Phantom Zone or something. But what about those years? That kind of, you know, the sort of, one of the innovations, I guess, of Marvel Comics in the 1960s was continuity, which we thought of as a wonderful plus. But I guess in your book, I'm sort of nostalgic for the non-continuity years when you could just pick up a Superman comic and not have to know what had been going on in all the other issues to be able to read it.
Yeah, that's in the 50s. Well, you know, throughout the 40s, it was Joe Shuster and Jerry Siegel's, you know, kind of Superman, even though they had a lot of ghosts working for them there. But then after the war, and after the comic books went through a shaky number of years, right after the war in terms of sales, and then the accusations of
seduction of the innocent, and
the seduction of the innocent, that comics were ruining children's lives. Superman still, you know, held on and still sold fairly well in the early 50s. And the guy who masterminded Superman comics from the early 50s all the way up through 1970 was this guy named Mort Weisinger. And it was his genius, really, to gradually create this coherent world around Superman. As I say in the book, in the first decade or more of the Superman stories, there were very few recurring characters. You know, there was Lois Lane, and there was Luther, and the Prankster, and Toy Man, and a few others, and Jimmy Olsen and Perry White, but very, very little beyond that, characters who came back. And it was Weisinger who devised this whole mythos, as it's called, in comicdom. The Bottle City of Kandor, Supergirl, Crypto the Superdog, all these characters. Gradually, he would introduce into the series throughout.
Comet the Super Horse. Don't forget Comet.
Comet the Super Horse. Yeah. Right.
And there was a monkey. There was a super monkey.
Yeah. I don't know if it was Beppo. I think. And all the LL and Lois Lane and Linda Lee and Lex Luthor and all that,
Lila
all that
Lara.
Kind of stuff. Yeah, right. And right, the mermaid.
Lori Lamar.
Yeah, right. So it was him that came up with the ideas to let's do this coherent world. But the stories weren't continued. I mean, they would be complete themselves and nothing that happened in any one story would really ever influence the next issue. I mean, there was like Lois Lane was going to marry Superman and did marry Superman, but it was a dream. So he introduced this coherence and this world that Superman could exist in with friends and adversaries, and that was a wonderful innovation, and it produced. They might not have been the most exciting comics, but they were great children's literature, you know, and they were meant for kids. I mean, the idea prevailing in the comics until Stan Lee and Marvel Comics was that comic books were basically written for people 9 to 13 years of age, and they figured that every 4 years there was a whole new people coming in, which is why every 3 or 4 years they'd redo the origin of Superman or the origin of Batman.
And come up with an 80-page giant with a bunch of 5-year-old stories that we haven't read before.
That's right. But then when the idea of continuity came in with primarily with Stan Lee's Marvel Comics, where everything tied together and people married people and killed people and characters died and all this other kind of stuff and things happened with repercussions, then it became kind of impossible for people just to kind of pick it up and read a comic book, and that was a major change.
Do you think maybe that's why DC Comics is laying off 20% of their staff? I mean, do you think less people are reading comics? Not for the same reason that less people are buying CDs or buying DVDs, but less people are reading comics because they're just too impenetrable to read now.
Well, they're too impenetrable, and they're $3 and $4 a piece. So if you're going to want to follow a story that goes from Superman to Wonder Woman, to Green Lantern, to Green Arrow, it's an awful lot of money.
Yeah, it's like $70 a month.
Yeah, $70 a month. And I just heard recently that comic sales last year from one August to the next August dropped 17%. So it is a problem with the cost and this kind of convoluted continuity, which is so super serious too. There's not much sense of having fun in these stories.
No, they have a lot of gravity.
Yes, they do.
Well, in fact, one of the things that puzzles me, and you mentioned it in your book, John Byrne in 1986, I believe, kind of restarted Superman. They ended him, and then they started him again. And one of the things they wanted to do was to keep him unique and not have Comet the Super Horse and not have ever had a Superboy, or for that matter, then I guess that would mean there would be no Legion of Superheroes and there would be no Bottled City of Kandor and all those things, that he would be the sole survivor of Krypton once again. And they did. They established this. So in 1986, he was the one and only survivor of Krypton for about 7.5 minutes.
That's exactly right. And everything came back in again.
I don't think I've seen Comet, but I think everything else.
Everything has come back in again. It's as if there's a dearth of imagination to go back to Mort Weisinger's things, from 30 years early and drag them back in, even though they would necessarily put a more adult or at least dark spin on these things, seemed preposterous. And my feeling was that a Superman comic where he was, in fact, the only superhero on Earth would be wonderful. That uniqueness that he had for at least for a while was I think one of the things that embedded him into the consciousness of all of us.
Another thing, and your book inspired me to go back and reread a bunch of old comic books. The comic books that Mort Weisinger was responsible for, or that Siegel and Shuster were responsible for, They had a lot of story in their limited 12 or 14 pages. Whereas today's books, they might be 25 pages, but they don't have very much story in them. They have like a lot of big drawings.
They do. Yeah. A lot of full-page drawings with people standing around, looking posed and saying kind of innocuous things that don't move a story along at all. Yeah.
Had they come from a comic strip idea of moving the story along in three panels at a time, or?
Yeah, well, I think the earliest comics, you know, comic books were based on how newspaper strips worked. In fact, the very first original comic book stories, or stories originally done for a comic book, would have a logo at the top of each page as if it were a Sunday page. And then in the 1940s, you know, Will Eisner and other artists began to kind of create a vocabulary and a pacing for comic books, but it was still based on the idea of a story with a beginning, a middle, and end. And those stories, Siegel's and Shuster's stories could run, you know, 11 or 12 pages, or they could run, you know, 40 pages. But they all had a beginning, middle, and end. And it seems that the comic books of the last, you know, several decades are endless.
They just have a middle.
Yeah, they just have a middle, exactly right.
Yeah. And a lot of breasts. There's way more breasts now than there ever were. Not that Lois Lane didn't always have breasts, but
oh my God, yeah. You look at the drawings of women, particularly in the 50s and 60s, they were what it used to be called modestly endowed, you know. And
yeah.
Now it's completely bizarre and zany.
There's a character in the Superman mythos whose name is Power Girl. She's the Supergirl of Earth 2 or something like that. And I don't think it's conceivable that any person that actually looked like her could walk.
Much less use superpowers.
She would need superpowers just to keep those breasts afloat. But, of course, you know, we all love looking at such things. Tom DeHaven is my guest, and his newest book is called Our Hero, Superman on Earth, and it's a fine book. And are you done now writing about comic books and about Superman?
Yeah, I think I am. This semester off, I teach at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, and I put in for a leave last spring, I got it. And what I did beginning in May, I rented an office. I'd always wanted to do this. I didn't want to work at home, you know, where home has so many interruption. So I rent an office, and I go to my office every day, and I have been every day. And it's this boring little office in an office park, and I'm surrounded by, you know, realtors and lawyers and stuff. And I go in there and I work. I've been working on two novels and a collection of monologues. I think these two novels, which I won't finish for another year or so. I'm just at this point. I'm not going to say this is the last novel I'll ever write, but I think at this point, when I finish those, I'd like to write comics again, not comic books, but to do some work in the comics field for a couple of years. So I don't mean the comics field like DC or Marvel, but just to do a graphic novel, although I despise that term, a fiction.
Say comic book. We like the term comic book.
Yeah, I like the word comic, a novel in comic book form.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to all of those things, your novels, your graphic novels, and I hope that you'll come back and talk to us again on From the Bookshelf when any of those things happen, or even if they don't.
Well, I hope they happen, but I'm glad to come back. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I want to thank our guest, Tom DeHaven, and his new book is called Our Hero, Superman on Earth. Thanks for being our guest this week. I also want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely and talented Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Hey, Breanne, thanks. Hey, check out our podcast page. It's kusp.org, or you can find us on iTunes and Facebook. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. See you next time.